Gray Grant.
Howdy. Hi.
Hello. That is a pretty dope name, if I'm being honest with you.
Thank you.
Is that your given name?
It is a name that I gave myself back a while. I am a trans-identified person. I'm a composer. Things to know to like really get the name backstory.
Yeah,
no, the
hit
name.
The bullets so that we know what's happening.
I'm a composer. I got a lot of composing degrees, but that doesn't matter. Anyone can do it. I like theater. I like writing for the theater. I like writing for opera, but I usually am not writing for operatic voices. We can get into that later. Anyway, first opera attempt at like an operatic project. I was writing like a non-binary, trans-non-binary character whose name was Gray, and that project fell through. But then when I was like, I don't like what my name is, I landed on Gray as like the new thing. So that is my name. That is my name. But I got it from a character that I created. So
do you mind if I ask you what your name was before you changed it? Does that bother you?
I do. I keep that private. Just because it's kind of irrelevant.
Sure. No problem. Yeah. No problem at all. I like Gray Grant. I am a big fan of the alliteration as a comic book fan. I've always found that that's a go-to with a pretty consistently good story is that alliterative name.
I thought it sounded really nice when I came up with it. As being an artist, like one, I wanted as a non-binary person, I wanted a sense of like happiness and like sense of like calmness in myself, but like also as an artist, I was like, ooh, this name is great. It's a good artist name.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Let me ask you just up front, because I want to make sure that we're on the same page about where this conversation is going, because you brought it up more than once. How comfortable are you talking about your identity as a trans person, a non-binary person? Yeah. Do you want to kind of sidestep that and not discuss it? Or are you cool?
Because I
can be curious
it.
Sometimes.
Yeah, we can talk about it. And then if there are things that I'm like, I don't want to answer that, then I'll just say that. And it'll be
and
fine.
I have no problem with that answer. Here's some acceptable answers some people don't want to give to me in all areas of discussion. I don't know. I'm fine with that. Why would that be a problem? I don't want to talk about it. Sounds fucking great. Let's talk about something else. Don't even worry about it.
Yeah.
Cool. Just if it comes up again, it's not like an agenda-based show, so I don't know. But I want to make sure I don't step on any toes or make anyone.
No, you're so good.
So with that being said, let's go back. I'll ask you my first question, which is my only stock question. Where are you from, Gray?
Yeah. Great. So I was born and raised from, in the sense of where are you from? Born and raised in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Which is why I have such a which is why I have such a connection with UNCSA. But then I moved up to Michigan, which is where I currently live, to go to school. I went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I had like, after my undergrad degree, I had like a brief stint in New York. I was going to go to a school which will remain unnamed just because, you know, reasons. And then about a weekend, I dropped out because it wasn't the vibe and it was too expensive and I wasn't getting the funding that I wanted.
Can I ask what was off about the vibe?
Oh, it was just like there was everything was a little messy. Classes that were, you know, said that they were one thing, I showed up and they were a different thing, or it turns out they weren't like going to fulfill the degree requirement that they were supposed to fulfill on paper.
Dig into too much detail if you don't want to, but I'm curious. How does that occur as far as like your investigation of the school up front and wanting to go there? And then what is maybe one example of it, a specific expectation where you're like, I'm here for this. And this is not what I was promised or told.
I mean, honestly,
or you didn't ask.
I mean, honestly, when I was like coming out of like my undergrad, I wanted to do more school at some point. I wanted to take a year and then to do more school. And so I was like took a year and I was pretty unhappy with like my job and I was ready to go back to school and find a way to like be more connected with my creative life. And so I just was kind of like, I like cast a wide net. I didn't cast a wide net. I like applied to three schools.
A medium net.
Yeah. A medium net. And one school, yeah, anyway, the school that I chose, I thought was going to be great. And then I just like showed up and for just like every single little tiny, minute, not worth mentioning thing along the way, just something went wrong that felt like a red flag.
Like the reason I prod a little is just because seems like such a quick time to make that up. Like it wasn't like 3 months in after spending a bunch of time. It was like, you felt almost like when someone walks into a haunted house and they're like, no,
it was pretty cool. There was a lot of like pre-semester, like organizational stuff that also was like not a thing. Like no one ever,
so you kind of, you know, like it was like, of it.
Yeah, it was just there was like a massive lack of communication from like the chair of the department to like incoming students. I just like, no one ever sent me like a form to like fill out to like give teacher preferences for like private study, which is a thing that you do in the world of composition in the academic world. You know, it just was kind of, it was a kind of organizational nightmare, which is sad because there are some really cool people there. But regardless, I dropped out after like a lot of crying in Washington Square Park and a lot of just like being on a lot of intense phone calls with people giving me advice. But I stayed because I like, you know, signed a lease. My roommate got me into like a choir in the city. I also sang. And so I was like, all right, I'll stick around for a year because New York is New York and there are lots of things to do here. Sure. It was great. There was lots of things to do. I like sang at the Koch Theater in a production of what was the ballet? The Ravel ballet, Daphnis and Chloe. It was like massive. It's a massive ballet with like a giant chorus in it, and the music is so gorgeous that often I think the choreo. Sorry to the classical ballet dancers out there, but often I think all the choreo that I've seen out there for Peleas kind of pales in comparison to the music. So like the productions are always a little lackluster. It's also why this piece in particular gets like played in like a concertized version. But yeah, I like did really cool stuff like that. Directed and did some dramaturgy for like my friend's experimental like no plot opera. Which
sure,
is great
hopped
because,
around and yeah, soaked yeah. in New York City for a year before you went to Michigan. Great.
Yeah, and then I like came back. I came back to Michigan after that year because I had a friend who I like had a gig in Michigan. And when I came back, we were chatting, and he mentioned that he was going to like live in a farmhouse in the next year, and I was like, oh, that's cool. And then like when I was back in New York, he texted me saying, hey, do you want to live in the farmhouse? And I was like, all right, great, cool, why not? I moved back one because the farmhouse was such a, like a kind of a romantic, it was like, I was really appealing to my like romanticized like need for like nature, which I didn't have in, Michigan. I'm a big nature kiddo. I love hiking. Michigan has the Upper Peninsula and Lake Superior and the Pitched Rocks, which are just massive, like 200, 300 cliffs along Lake Superior. It's really great. And I also like had a community here that I was like deeply missing. So
let me make sure
I
get the timeline right here. Yeah, yeah. So when was the first time you ever went to Michigan?
I went to Michigan for my undergraduate degree, 2012 to 2016. New York was 2017 to 2018. And then I've been back ever since.
So you went straight from Winston to Michigan and then to New York. And then you decided, I actually really like being in Michigan. Yeah. Let me go back.
Yeah, I like the small town vibe. I like, you know, I don't know. It's just the speed.
No, you don't have to talk me into that. I live in LA, but I absolutely have lived in a lot of small towns. I love that vibe. Mm-hmm. Let me back up a little bit so that I can get some perspective here. So you grew up in Winston. Can we talk parents? What are your parents doing for work? Great. And you getting along well with them as a kid?
Yeah, they're lovely. I just saw my parents. They came up for a premiere that I did, and they're great. My dad's like a he's like an IT girly. He's not a girly, but he's an IT girly. he works on servers. He does server security, things that I don't know about. He was like a rural North Carolina kid who managed to get like classic Doctor Who somehow on his television. And like was a band kid.
Nerd
and
dad.
Then my mom
I say with love
absolute nerd dad Race. Just like, you know, he went to see Star Wars, the original, like 17 times in the theaters when it came out.
Yeah. All right.
Before it was a thing.
And then he was in the paper, I'm sure, for how many times he went to see Star Wars.
Probably.
Talk about, what about mom? What's mom up to?
Mom also grew up as like a rural kiddo in Winston-Salem, but it was a part that is like now no longer rural, is a part that is now like, it went from like the classic like rural to suburban kind of like zoning type thing.
What city is this, or what town is it?
Winston.
Winston. You're talking about, okay, yeah, of course. Yeah. Winston was far more rural, especially on the north side.
Yeah. And she went to school. My parents both went to Chapel Hill, and that's where they met.
Okay,
and
is
she
that was going met?
To.
Got it.
Yeah, she was going to be like an education person, but turns
Do you
out.
You mean teacher, or did you mean
as
something
in like
else
a teacher?
That?
Yeah, as a teacher, okay. She wanted to be a teacher. School did not agree with her. So she, you know, she was like a person who like did office jobs here and there. And then when she was a mother, she became a mother. But it's like she's super involved with their church. It's been her church her entire life. She's like very proudly now something that she's been gunning for several years. And then a few years ago, finally is on, but she's like, on the funeral committee, which is like a big deal to her, which I find really, really cool. Also because, I'm like there's something out there, a concept out there called the good death. And there's like a death advocates, things like that. And I'm aligned with those people. The premiere that my parents just came up to see was a show about death. It was a show about like ritual and like culture and death in the US. And like, I'd like talked about those things kind of vaguely, while I sang about them, and like while I was doing this, I was doing a home funeral on my partner, and that's like the show. So anyway, me and my mom love chatting about the funeral committee. Yeah.
Sound a little cagey about talking about this, as if you're like worried that I'm going to judge you for being into death. Are you?
No. I just like have a my like kind of public persona, my interview public speaking persona is always like a little chaotic and a little bit like fast.
I'm into it. I don't want you to get the impression I'm not into it. I'm just also kind of an immediacy person that calls things out. No, I love that. When I was just, I'll give you a little context because I don't know how much of the show you've ever heard, so how much you know anything about me, but when I was, I don't know if I've ever said this on the show actually, so nice. Might actually get to bring up a new thing. Rare. When I was like 20, I had a summer where I got really into researching like biographies of people. And I'd never really done that before just growing up. If they taught me something in school, or, you know, I learned something from a friend, or maybe I watched a documentary, but I didn't go out of my way to like research people's stories. And I got into a few people that summer, Andy Kaufman, a few different people. I was like, I want to know everything that happened to them. One of the people I got into was Dr. Jack Kevorkian. And you know who that is?
No, I'm humming as if I do, but I am Googling this name right now.
Look it up. They called him Dr. Death.
Yes, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, he is. He was a very famous dude for a bunch of reasons. The main one for our listeners who may not Google it right away. The main one being that he was a death advocate. I mean, he was someone that if he was trying to help people find a way to accomplish assisted suicide, basically.
Yeah, I do. I have read about this guy. He's a
fascinating
good one.
Fella. And if you hear especially the stuff about his earlier life, everyone in his family is like, this kid wanted to know everything about death from the time he was a little kid. And it wasn't like a morbid, like he would kill stuff or he was, and he didn't say it was some sort of like, yeah, tell me, but like he was just constantly fascinated by it. It was like as if like some kids get into nature. This kid got into death. It was just his thing of like wanting to understand why it happens, how it happens, when it happens, how people feel about it, all this kind of stuff. And I remember at the time I had a friend that I was hanging out with that summer. And they were like, what are you up to, dude? We might have been smoking a joint or something. And he was like, hey, what have you been up to? And I was like, man, I got a whole stony rant about, you know about this Dr. Death, Dr. Kevorkian dude. And I went on for way longer than I just did.
I love
and this
that.
Guy was like, bro, are you good? Like, are you good?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I was just learning about this guy.
Yeah.
To so many people, any interest in the subject is incredibly off-putting.
Yeah.
They well, just instantly like, don't want to encounter it.
I mean, well, that's why I try, and I say this with all sincerity, that's why, like, I talk about, like, death and cool death stuff often, because it is important to destigmatize it. One of the big problems that we have as, like, a culture in the United States is that we have built ritual, at least I speak for, like, kind of, like, the white America, because there are, like, other death ritual practices and, like, and like
sure then, you like, mean the, more the Western Americanized like
yes
culture
exactly
yeah.
but we have like rituals that are like really that are so formal and stoic and are super performance heavy for I guess the community around us it really kind of like shuts off like the kind of primary grieving individuals like the people closest more closely related to the dying person or the dead person, it shuts them off from like having a way to like confront their emotions, feel their emotions, which is a very important thing. If you've ever been to therapy, it truly the only way out is through and to like process your emotions. And also, grief is like such a wild monster that happens in so many different ways. We just like have made grief a thing that we kind of perform to get through it, and then we're kind of like left with like
pieces.
Fuck all, yeah,
yeah.
Pardon.
No, fuck all is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
What?
Great.
When did this interest start for you, Greg?
Yeah. So there's a YouTuber out there that you should definitely check out. Who
great.
Is not just a YouTuber, but she is like a mortician and like good death advocate named Caitlin Doty, who has her YouTube channel is called Ask a Mortician. It's been around for a long time.
I
she
love
also
that.
Has like three books out. One's a memoir. One is about, which is incredible, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. We're just now doing a segment on Caitlin Doty, and I love it. Two, her second book was about like death practices globally, which is like really nice and like a nice way of like putting death in perspective. And then the third book is like questions children ask about death, which is like really nice because often, you know, kids will ask the most immediate and most sometimes confronting thing first because
yeah.
they don't have that filter. But yeah, Caitlin Doty, she's great. I kind of like watched her videos around and they're really lovely. And then I ended up getting commissioned to write a song cycle for this baritone named Elliot Franks, who lives in San Francisco, who is a lovely man and delightful. I was commissioned by a third party to write a song cycle for him. And we like got together. I was like, hello, this other party wants me to write a piece for you. Tell me about yourself. And Elliot, and one of the reasons why we got paired together is because we both like, I mean, I am like trans feminine. Elliot is like a trans mask guy. He's a trans man. We got paired together for like kind of that shared experience. But I didn't want to necessarily write a piece about that because there are more things to write about than that. And Elliot, let's see, how can I condense this? And Elliot is like talked about this on like NPR. So it's like, it's out there. Being trans.
I'm sorry, this is the best platform
yeah.
I could get you
yeah.
today. And
no,
that he got
no.
NPR and that
it's
you're on
cool.
this. That
I
sucks,
say that,
man.
I say that more in the sense of like, it's like, I'm not like breaking any like kind of consent boundaries with like him and his story.
Got it. Yes, I appreciate that.
But so when you are a trans masculine person taking a hormone replacement therapy, HRT, it changes your voice. Your voice will drop and weird things happen and all in your throat. I'm like gesturing to my throat. I forget that this isn't a visual medium.
It also is.
Oh, nice. But Elliot, he had a like a fabulous career as a mezzo soprano in the Bay Area, like operatic scene. And when he decided, no more, I must do this, he kind of knew it was going to like probably end his like vocal career. And it did, because he transitioned later in life, like I think like 40s-ish. And when you do that, everything in your throat, your vocal folds, a lot of that is less elastic. It's very settled. It doesn't have the same flexibility and elasticity as like it might when you were like in your like, you know, late teens, early 20s. I may not be using the exact right like medical terminology, but that's vaguely,
cool. I think you're giving us more of a window than we would have had otherwise.
Yeah. We're just, I'm a tangential girly. I love just like going on a long story. So yeah, anyway, that happened. Elliot, you know, it kind of ended his career, but then he also had like kind of a long-term fascination with death and things like that. So he got a job in a funeral home. And I was like, well, that's really cool. I also kind of have an interest in this. So we were going to write a piece about a mortician, is what we kind of landed on. And then I did a lot of research, to the point where I like very briefly thought, should I go to mortuary school? I think I could be really good at this. But then I didn't, because I didn't want to go to 4 years of mortuary school. So I like, that's, this project, this song cycle, was kind of the start of all of this. Also, I also usually write my librettos for myself a lot of the time. I'm like a singer songwriter who writes things that are too complicated for a singer songwriter, because I went to school, and so now I have too many ideas, and it's like it's a mixed meter nightmare.
I appreciate it though, and I think that it sounds like at least you're determined to sort through them all. Let me back up a little bit, because I love this death conversation. I feel like we'll get back to it. When did you start writing music? And maybe the follow-up to that too is like, when did you start paying attention really to the craft of songwriting? Because I feel like most songwriters I know, and I know a few, you don't always realize that's what you're doing at first. And usually your first experience songwriting is not looking at a staff and plotting notes. That develops. But so when did it start? And then when did it become a little more formal?
Sure. So, I mean, super young. I was a young kid, like a 5-year-old that was always singing, making up songs to themselves. But then
more so than you were singing other people's songs? Like, were you singing shit from the radio also? Or did you do a lot of coming up with your own stuff? Do you remember?
I have no idea. I do not. I wouldn't know.
Okay.
But
sure.
And when I was like in fifth grade, fourth grade, I think, when you like everyone has to play recorder. Our final project was like writing a song for a recorder. And we were taught how to, you know, part of that like recorder curriculum is kind of learning how to read sheet music. Right. And so I like my friend in third grade was like, hey, you should write a piece about these kids who get ground up in a meat grinder at a meat grinder factory. And I was like, what? That incredible. Yeah. So I wrote an entire suite called the Meat Grinder Suite for solo recorder. That like had this wild plot that kind of turned into like,
were there like lyrics?
There was random songs in the middle of it that you just stopped playing the recorder and singing it. It was
tremendous. There's something like musically disturbing happening to you early. Yeah.
It also like ended with like this like kind of like anti-capitalist flair of like, the meat grinder factory closed down after the kids died, and then it like tanked the economy of the local town because it relied on
Gray. Yeah. Course it did. I can't believe how absolutely soaking with death your first piece was. I should not be surprised.
Wow, I haven't put that together. But yeah,
so just that's, dripping that's the first with thing the blood of children out the gate. So that's a cool place to start. And then later you did what? Puppies and rainbows having fun on the moon or something?
Yeah, exactly. I love comedy. I respect it too much. Every single thing that I've written has been like very intense and like has made like everybody cry. And I like wish that there was a way. I just need to like take it in improv class or something. But like,
I think the key is?
I need to write something funny.
You just need to take the same serious shit that you've written and give it to incredibly funny performers. Just cast it differently. And I'm telling you, the best comedy is from performers who are taking dead serious stuff too serious. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I actually already wrote 8 comedies. I just was taking it too seriously at the time. You'd be surprised.
Yeah, I'm sure. Honestly, I can see like the absurdity of like a very kind of like self-righteous home funeral opera. There's definitely humor in there.
It could crush. I mean, I haven't seen your work, but you crush those kids. I don't see why not. When does it become then though something more serious of I'm going to go to school for this. This is my life. This is what I'm doing right now. Yeah. 100%.
So, from what I've listened to the podcast, I understand that you are a musical theater girly as well.
I would say that some people have said that about me.
Okay, great. Cool. Or at least a theater girly.
I did lots of musicals in high school. Okay, lots.
Yeah. So that was me. I was like a performer first. But all the high school musical. I mean, in middle school, I peaked because I like got to play Ryan from High School Musical. And one of the first like MTI, you know, like.
Right. It must like, be brand
school
new.
School productions. Yeah, it was great. I went on Radio Disney for it. It was iconic. My
senior year was Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
So I was just a few years behind you there.
Oh, yeah. It like really like inflated my ego and I thought I was it. But then I got to high school and they casted me in all the like comedic relief roles and like the musicals that do not sing. So I was like King Pellinor from Camelot, who like has a dog and he's just kind of a wacky guy. I don't know the rabbi's comedic relief, but I got cast as the rabbi and fiddler, which we were a very Christian high school. And I don't know if we needed to have done fiddler, but
I love when a bunch of Christians do fiddler, man. It is offensive in a way, for sure.
I know. There was one Jewish, who was a friend of mine, but there's like one Jewish student who was in fiddler and he was just so upset about how it was being done.
So I got
all the roles that I didn't want to get. I was gonna be Lancelot and I was shocked that I wasn't. I was composing in like my piano lesson some. And so composition became kind of like a B plot for me.
That's making sense to me.
I like wrote some incidental music for like some one acts that we did in my like theater class in high school. UNCSA connection though. I will say, when I was in high school before UNCSA, I like showed up to like play a kid in a UNCSA, like a year 4 production of Eugene O'Neill's All Wilderness Wild Show.
Do you remember the director of that by chance?
It was a really lovely lady who had long hair, I think.
I remember that.
I did check our Facebook mutuals and you are friends of people who are in that cast.
That was done while I was at school,
Morgan,
for sure.
Yeah. Was in that cast. And that's the only name. And his partner from that theater company that they had was also in that cast.
Brian,
yeah.
They've both done the podcast before.
There you go. I haven't talked to them since that production, but they were great.
Well, they were within the last few years. So if you want to know what they're up to.
Nice. I'll have to go back and check that out.
Yeah, Joshua was just on in the fall of last year, or maybe the year before. But yeah, he's doing a new thing where he helps artists get their business lives together.
Very smart. I need that.
Oh, he's great. I recommend Artist Strategy. It's a school of the arts thing. As far as the people that founded it, Joshua and Mike are great, and Hassan Muhammad, who also works with them, they're all really smart. They're all about like treating your art as a business and being smart about that. And so we decide we're going to start taking the music seriously because it was a B plot. But then you're like, when, at what point of your high school did you go to school of the arts? When did you move?
So I did like a UNCSA summer intensive for composition. And that was kind of the gateway drug.
Summer session went well for you?
Yeah, it was a nice time. It was cute. And then I decided I was going to apply to UNCSA for like operatic voice, which is kind of a nightmare audition scenario. I just was not prepared. It was very funny. Steve Lacoste was, he's like my opera dad. I also did like a lot of Fletcher. I was like the kid who did a lot of Fletcher stuff when they needed kids.
Right.
I was a part of the same children's chorus that Drake Duffer was in, and this is how all that connection was also happening.
Sure. Drake Duffer from a few episodes ago. In the winter, or in December, as it were.
Yeah. sorry. I'm all over the place. But yeah, I had a lot of UNCSA connections prior. I also did I did the ballet prep program, which is another wild thing. I was a Nutcracker kid. I was an Act One kiddo.
You were all over campus growing up then.
I was. Was like, I wanted to perform. I really, that's all I wanted
to
do.
When you managed to in a number of ways before other people were able to. I mean, you're getting on campus as a kid, and so many other people are busting ass just to get on campus while they're paying to be students there. So that's pretty impressive. Do you mind if I ask when your transition began in this whole story? Like, as it relates to your singing voice is my main question, honestly.
Transition in what sense? Like vocally? Are you talking about gender or?
I'm talking about gender as far as like you were talking about hormones and how they affect things. Okay. Obviously, the direction is not the same, but I just want to ask how that relates to this whole timeline.
Sure. It doesn't relate to this part of the timeline, really. Being trans femme, your voice stays the same. You can vocal train it up, but I'm not a woman. And that's not something I desired to be. I just am not a man, and I didn't want to be a dude. This gender was like a post UNCSA thing. Like I went to college and, UNCSA was a, I'm queer in some way type of thing. It definitely cracked like the gay / queer egg.
That hadn't occurred to you before you got to school of the arts.
I came out as bisexual like the last month of my junior year in high school, and then when I was bi until like the first week at UNCSA, where I was like, oh no, that's just about the boys. That's all it's about.
Hey, that's the journey for so many. Yeah. That is definitely the journey for so
and
many.
I still feel a little guilty about that. Like, the whole
why
it's a disservice to the bisexuals out there. Because that's
offensively. Bisexual, and that doesn't hurt my feelings.
Well, you know how everyone thinks that bisexuals are just on their way to like one thing or another, like that.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. I'm married to a completely straight woman.
Yeah.
But that doesn't diminish my bisexuality. I absolutely know what you're talking about, but I also feel like, and I think you can appreciate this. I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but I think that we all evolve on how we identify, how we relate to what these words mean to us. I have not identified as bisexual. I'm sure you can find recordings of me saying I'm just straight up straight, because in my head, because I didn't want to like date and marry a man. That didn't occur to me as something that I necessarily wanted to do despite attraction or sexual activity with them. I was like, well, then I'm really just a straight guy who like does gay stuff. Like that's how I thought about it for a long time. Cause I didn't know the words to use.
Yeah.
But those words evolve and change. And I think that that's another thing that I'm really appreciative of. It definitely, when I talk to any of my trans friends about it, it's like the more flexible we can all be to try to figure out what the hell we're talking about, the more we all win, right? Like that's really the goal of all this. Like, what do we mean when we say I am this, or this is how I feel, or what? Like digging into that is the question. That's the game that we all should be up to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I am. It's been kind of just a very, it's been a wild, flexible journey. I think I have occupied probably, I've been so many different genders. Like we've really kind of like run the gambit. I was like I did identify as a woman for like a short while, but it just like, it didn't work out for me. It wasn't what I was feeling. But so we started over on like one side, on like the dude side, and then like shot over to like a nice middle place. And then we shot over to like woman. And then we kind of like made our way back to the middle. And then we made our way a little bit further back to men. And then we've come back over here. And now it's very funny.
That's the thing that doesn't, like, as someone who grew up in a really conservative place, and I guess you did as well, depending on where you were, part of town you're at a given time, it's like, even in our lifetimes, that has evolved from such a binary conversation. Because I think even if you played what you just said back to yourself when you were like 14, I don't know. Oh. For me, I would be like, wait, what?
It would have made zero way? Sense.
Yeah, it doesn't even occur, because you're like, I'm either this or I'm that, or I'm this or I'm that. Like, you're really trying to fit yourself into this hole, or, well, excuse my language. You're really trying to fit yourself into this category or this box. And really, one of the things that I love, and I wish more people would kind of meet all the communities at, which is like, it's not permanent. Like things change and feelings change. And especially when you grow up thinking things are so binary, of course you're going to evolve and change. And it doesn't even have to be the same it was 2 years ago.
And a lot of the change and I'm sure there are some linguists out there that will correct me, but a lot of it is like the evolution of language that we have access to, and like what is popular language to talk about gender, has like thus like shaped our understanding of what it is. Like I was a non-binary person for many years before someone ever like said or texted the word MB to me, ENBY. Mm-hmm. And when they texted that to me, I was so confused when they said that, oh, you're such a cool MB, and I have no idea what they're talking about. And this is like another trans person. But yeah, like the language has been such like a incredible vehicle for discovery, for and like just like growth and like the gender queer sexuality journey.
Right.
Which is so nice.
Which also makes America a unique place to experience any version of non like heteronormative life, which is that, and I've talked to people about this on the podcast recently who are from other countries and people whose first language is not English, especially not American English. American English is so special in that, more so than maybe any other language in history, it aggressively seeks to better adjust to the circumstance of what that person is trying to communicate. And when any other language almost throughout all of human history looks at a word or a situation and finds that it doesn't properly fit it or whatever, it's like, whatever, these are the words we have. Good luck.
Yeah.
American English looks at every situation through its people and goes, is there another word we could use that's better than this for that? Like at the end of the day, once we get all the way down these paths, there's really two versions of that thing. So are we using this word accurately when we describe both of them this way? Like, and other languages to this day, Spanish, Italian, they don't do that. They're old languages. They don't have a million words for, I think, what was the example? It's a girl from Brazil gave me. She was like, we're talking in Portuguese and you just say bread. Like you just say bread. And then you look at the bread and then you deal with what kind of bread it is later. But in America, is it a cupcake? Is it a muffin? Is it a scone? Is it a, like you have to get so nitty gritty, but it's such a particular thing for people who are trying to identify themselves to live in a place where the language is almost trying to keep up with them as they identify who they are.
Yeah.
You see what I, does that make any sense?
Oh no, totally. Yeah. I mean, and it's, I am not like a queer theorist.
I didn't mean to flabbergast you.
But there's so many like wonderful, I love a video essay. I love a YouTube video essay. There's so many like wonderful like rabbit holes that go down to like learning about like the history of Tumblr and neopronouns and like Tumblr and like the like kind of like the like hyper-specific genders and like all these weird things that like frantic young people, and when I say this, I mean like frantic like 12 to like 16 year olds were like doing on Tumblr to try to find themselves, but it was happening at a rate so quickly that they were creating language and then like immediately discarding it. And they're like many like micro gender, or not micro, but they're like many hyper-specific like gender identifiers that have like don't have like any record of being used other than like one Tumblr post out there.
Come and gone.
But it's like in, but it's like coming out of this like, you know, adolescent like sense of agency and newness and confusion that like all these things come from, and then, you know, eventually they
Been there as long as there's been people, but then these people have access to this specific
The internet really did some wild shit for gender and sexuality
and I think all for the better, frankly, because even the more extreme things, like sometimes I see some people talking about pronouns or talking about gender identity in a way that even I like to think of myself as progressive and open-minded. I'm certainly not like lacking in LGBT people in my life. Like, but even when they describe what they're talking about, I have to be like, what? Like, I'm here for it. But what are you even saying? I've lost track of it, but I'm not, that doesn't upset me even so. And it doesn't even push me away necessarily. I don't automatically like adopt it or agree with what they're saying if I can't get it, but it doesn't push me away because I'm like, whatever it is, we're doing the work. We're figuring it out. And that's what the whole cool part about this is, because there are people all throughout history who have been trans or non-binary or this or that, whatever words we're currently using in 2024. And they didn't have access to those words. And so they were just different, or they were just weird, or they were just whatever word they had that day.
Yeah.
So I love seeing the work done. That's just one of my favorite things, because I think so many people are afraid to change things because they're worried the things they love will get destroyed. But man, it's brave shit to go out there and try to change the words. Am I wrong? Like, that's a crazy thing to go out and change the words. In France, it's like against the law.
That's wild. France.
You can't change the words. They're the words. I love this. I wish we had like so much more time. I'm gonna have to cut it a little bit short, but
we're almost to the end.
We're getting there, and I feel like we've gotten to all these cool places that I would love to crack open more with you at another time. I'll definitely have to have you back. You mentioned some of the stuff you've recently been working on. It definitely seems like the track, as we often talk about, for people, you know, some people, the last person, I just had an interview earlier today and I don't know when it'll be out, so I don't want to be too specific, but I talked to someone who started at School of the Arts doing vocal, performance in the music school. Now they work in post-production and editing in film and television. you seem a little bit more like you're headed down that track in a maybe different way, but you're still writing music. You're still singing. Yeah. You're still putting that stuff together. Does it feel to you like you're still at kind of the beginning of a very lifelong journey with that?
Oh,
or is
of
that
course.
Your well, immediate future only? What do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm also I'm a marketing girly because I am not like a person who can support themselves as an artist fully. So we're like doing arts nonprofit stuff. But yes, absolutely. I've spent too much time. I've invested too much time and energy into being an artist. The thing that I'm coming back around to more for being a composer is coming back around to like being a performer. Yes, I absolutely did write a role for myself to like do like an evening length performance where I bury my partner, because I wanted to perform more. And it's been really delightful and really lovely. Becoming a theater person again, and like in the sense of like I'm moving away from like opera and just kind of like just moving into the in-between space of whatever combination of music and
people in room watching performer.
Yeah, exactly. Period. It's been really nice. Like now, like
that.
Now theater maker is back on the resume as a header, you know, it's a great time. And I really like it. So it's, yeah, that's where we're going. That's where we're going to continue to go. I have I've been a part of a real quick so I can get all the things. And
please.
I'm a part of an organization called Fifth Wall Performing Arts, which is based in New York and Michigan. And that's like all we do is like create new experimental theater. That's kind of been that like genre of indie space. We have a show coming up in New York, with the Contemporaneous, ensemble. They're like a chamber orchestra. That's like a chamber rock opera that has a lot of prog rock vibes and a lot of heavy grooves. And it's really weird. It's very postmodern. It's like my friend cobbled together his journal entries and my poetry and his old like voice memos. He's a percussionist, so like voice memos of grooves and stuff, and like my old discarded arias from the Grey opera that I mentioned, and like slammed it together in a piece based on ideas, and about moments of transition, things like that. So that's coming to New York in June. So yeah, we're still performing, and it's great and it's really lovely. So that, yeah, it's like we're doing art.
Ray Grant, I'm going to say thank you. I got ahead, but yeah. I really got to say thank you as well. I really appreciate your candidness and openness and talking about all this stuff. And also fascinating. I find you to be a fascinating person.
Oh, well, thanks,
so
Rob.
Thanks for that. Thanks for being fascinating, because otherwise these are very dry episodes.
Oh, I could talk on and on and on. Thanks so much. This is such a pleasure.